What I'm teaching has been around for a long time. And what I said about British Israelite people and Worldwide Church of God people, I want to tell you there are going to be a lot of them in heaven. It isn't any particular new thing to have people try to graft Christianity onto the old trunk of Abraham's stock. That was the first fight in the New Testament church, and it's never been resolved. Somebody help over there. Until Paul came along, all the disciples, no exception, that had been taught by Jesus throughout his ministry, tried to make Christianity an add-on to Judaism, or vice versa. God had to knock Paul down, take him to the desert, and teach him as a private tutor. Or Christianity would have been Moses' message with Christ added on. That's why the book of Hebrews had to be written. That's why two-thirds of the New Testament was written with a man that God called to counteract that. And those Judaizers still wouldn't give in. They would not admit that Paul was right. They just had to give up in trying to change him, because he wouldn't give place to them for an hour. He said the gospel of Christ was at stake, the good news, and it was. And they wore him down. I am convinced they wore Paul down because he thought the Lord was coming so soon. And there was a world out there to hear the good news. He wouldn't bog down fighting them. The problem's never been resolved. And the older I get, the longer I minister, the more I begin to understand the prophecy that Claire Grace gave me. And what my function in the church is going to be. Paul left an unfinished battle, unresolved. Now, in the church that he built, Galatia, where he said, "You have many teachers, but only one Father," speaking spiritually, he got emotional about it there, and he told them where to get off at. And called them what they were, perverts, tent fondlers, children of bondage, and said, "Throw the mothers out." But the job's never really been done adequately. And every generation of the church has had to deal with the attempts to put new wine in old wineskins. That's what the British Israelites did when they discovered the truth about the lost tribes, though they limited it more than they should have. The entire Celtic nations represent the lost tribes, not just the British. They then resurrected the old wineskins. They were sincere, just as sincere as James and Peter, and, you know, I'm not about to say all those disciples of Christ went to hell. I don't think they did. I firmly believe that God let James get his head cut off to keep him from totally ruining the church. Same God that delivered Peter from prison could have stayed the hand of the swordsman. He had to shut the old fool up. James the jerk. That's what he was. He was so hung up on his self-righteousness, he misinterpreted Scripture about Abram and Rahab. The problem's never been resolved. That's about time somebody rescue lost truth. Now, some of the best research on this subject has been done by the people who were caught up in the error. And that's why I can't recommend too many of their books, because the research of facts is solid. The interpretation and application is where they get wrong. You won't find any better genealogists in the world than the Mormons. Nowhere. If you want to trace your genealogy, get a little help from them. And I have no quarrel with the Mormons. I expect to see a lot of them in heaven. But I don't agree with where they push their concepts. I am one who does not believe that Joseph Smith was a fraud. And those that do more than look casually have to conclude there was no way this illiterate man could have conjured up, without help from some source, what he let loose. Most errors in the church have come about by taking a piece of truth and pushing it too far. Now, the only place that I want to take this truth that's been pushed too far by the British Israelites and by the worldwide Church of God, I only want to take it as far as the facts go, to demonstrate that God never fails any of his promises. I then don't want to put on Saul's armor. I don't want to go back and become an activated recipient of their promises, Joseph's house or Judah's house. I expect to rule and reign over them both. I'm not interested in their promises. I don't want the alley cat, I want the Siamese. I'm like the brother. I'm taking the Siamese cat and leaving the alley cat and saying, now you choose. I got better promises. That's what the book of Hebrews is about. Remember, before I ever, if I could put the teaching that I do in proper perspective, what did I do for 5 years in this church when I came to town as pastor before I did a single one of these subjects? I taught 5 years verse by verse through the book of Hebrews. I'm sorry a lot of you came along after that was finished. There was a reason for that. Because these truths so turn people on, you're liable to slip back. Say, well, you know, it's pretty wonderful. See God take care of these people like he's taking care of them. I'm one of them. I'm going to start conforming to the conditions of their covenant. And you retreat into trying to live like an Israelite or live like a Jew. I got better promises than either one of them. You know, I'll be damned if I'll take a Model T Ford when a Ferrari is in the garage for me to pick. Comprenez-vous? But as I teach on these subjects, all, you know, a glaze goes over the eyes of certain ones that have read the Chaos Occults. And thus, the rich springboard of faith is broken down. Now, the truth that I teach, as I've said, have been taught by many others. Most of the books are out of print. I can't recommend them, except to people that have heard me teach and put all the gestalt together, because they got little pieces of truth and tried to connect a picture before some other dots were filled in. I mean, this book, for example, is worth throwing in the wastebasket rather than let somebody read it just because of what they do in misinterpreting the parable of the two eagles in the book of Ezekiel. And they make some other gross errors. But the factual foundation, before they start interpreting, absolutely sound. One of the best books ever written on a subject. J. H. Allen, Judah's Scepter, and Joseph's Birthright. They have a chapter on grace versus race. One of the finest ever written. But after you plow through the air and sort out the truth, which is what the teacher's supposed to do. I mean, I read for Watt Stewart from New York University one summer at Cal State at Chico. Probably the finest expert on Latin American history in America. More than anyone else, he turned me on to Latin American history. So eager to learn about it, I covered all of South and Central America, every country in South and Central America except one, Paraguay, in 6 weeks. As I was his reader, every person in the class, from a vast reading list, had to read 5 books a week. He had to skim it, obviously. What do you think I had to do? I was a reader. I had to grade their papers that summarized these books. If they all chose the same 5, my task was easy. If 100 students chose 5, each of them separate, I had a week of work. Then he would teach, and in a few words, steer us through the maze of all these different histories, which are his stories. Well, that's what I'm supposed to do, if you give me the time to do it. I can pick the good. Everybody says, where'd I get that book? Well, the one on Dan I'm going to let you have. Could be this weekend, but it could not be this weekend. These others, after I teach you a while, you can buy them and lift the good out and reject the bad with no trouble. Remember, I used to give away the pyramid book. The thing that was wrong with it was the interpretation of Daniel. He's written another one now, and that part's left out, so it'll be easier to give the book away. But it was wrong in its interpretation of Daniel and his 70 weeks. And I used to hate to give that book away, and still do, for fear people will think when they come to that section, I wish I could give it away and just rip the last few pages out. Because it's all wet when it comes to that part. And such good scholarship on the pyramid is clouded with an attempt to twist Daniel into conformity when he doesn't have to be. I haven't said that to qualify this book. I've been reading a little book about Dan, which you're not interested in. And I got to Hercules last night, didn't I? The origin of the Grecian Hercules, or rather Heracles as it is in the Greek, seems to me to have been in the daring adventures and exploits of the... That's where I left off last night, right? Exactly what I said. Right there. If I read 2:4 tonight, won't have anywhere to read tomorrow night, will I? Well, the discussion of Dan has been around a long time. There's a whole chapter about it in this book. The prophecies which dying Jacob gave concerning what the posterity of each of us... I'm into this book now. I know how to get back to that one. Do I have your permission? Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter at all. The prophecies which dying Jacob gave concerning what the posterity of each of his sons was to become in the last days is recorded in the 49th chapter of Genesis. You know that. In the 17th verse is a part of the prophecy concerning the tribe of Dan. The first clause of which, according to the King James translation, reads as follows. Quote, Dan shall be a serpent by the way, end quote. A better translation is as follows, and I agree with this. Quote, Dan shall be a serpent's trail. You need to write that in the margin. Dan shall be a serpent's trail. It's a better translation of Genesis 49:17. A few points in the history of the children of Dan will show us how they became a serpent's trail. In the division of the land by lot, a narrow strip of seacoast country west of Ephraim and Benjamin fell to Dan. But this country soon became too small for the tribe, as we're told in the following. Quote, the coasts of the children of Dan went out too little for them. Therefore the children of Dan went up to fight against Leshem and took it and smote it with the edge of the sword and possessed it and dwelt therein and called Leshem Dan after the name of Dan their father. Joshua 19:47. Now, don't turn to these other verses. Just alongside that prophecy of Dan in the 49th chapter of Genesis, just write these other references. Joshua 19:47. Now, you're going to find some repetition here as I illustrate how many different scholars have looked at the same subject and come up with certain conclusions that are similar. Concerning the Danites, we also have the following. You need to write this in the margin alongside Genesis 49:17. Not the whole verse, just the reference. Judges 18:11-12. And there went from thence of the family of the Danites, out of Zorah and out of Eshtoal, 600 men appointed with weapons of war. And they went up and pitched in Kirjath-Jearim in Judah. Wherefore they call that place Mahanadan, unto this day, a territory in Judah's lot. They took and renamed it Mahanadan. Same chapter, Judges 18:29. Again, we're told concerning this same people of 600 that they came to Laish. Quote, a people that were at quiet and secure. Weren't doing a dang thing. These Danites just descended on them out of the blue. And they smote them with the edge of the sword and burnt the city with fire. They built a city and dwelt therein. And they called the name of the city Dan, after the name of Dan their father, who was born unto Israel. Howbeit the name of the city was Laish at the first. That's Judges 18:29. Now, considering the fact that by the writing of the Chronicles, Dan is not even included in the genealogies, God, who controls the writing of his book must have some reason to have these three references about Dan all say essentially the same thing. They are on the move, taking territory, and putting their name on it. A company of Danites went to Lesham. It became Dan. A company of Danites went to Kirjath-Jearim. It became Mahanadan. They went on to Laish, and it ceased to exist. But they left their trail, Dan, the name of their father. And thus their trail can be traced not only from Dan to Beersheba, but to the islands of the sea, both Balan and Bawada, for Dan had an inland country and a coast country. The inland company of Danites went west with the overland column, and the coast company went Bawada, for Dan abode in his ships. Thus we have the prophecy concerning the ships of Tarshish. Now Tarshish is always a debatable subject. There are those that say Tarshish generically means the edge of the world. And therefore, to those that considered the territory of Spain, the Iberian Peninsula, as the edge of the world, and the Pillars of Hercules or the Straits of Gibraltar as going off the deep end, then it became known as Tarshish. Or Tarshish, because it was the edge of the then known world to them. When the islands called the British Isles came to be known, that pushed the edge of the world even further. So it came to be known as Tarshish. Like Ararat means the highest mountain. It now sticks to one mountain in South Turkey. But it was a generic term for the highest mountain. And when Noah landed on Ararat, it meant he landed on the highest mountain. And that mountain in South Turkey ain't the highest mountain. Tradition has just identified it as the landing place, and it wasn't. That's why I ain't going to find Noah's Ark there. That's a waste of somebody's money. Tarshish, generically, edge of the world. Because for a long time, and those happen to be biblical times, it was identified with Spain, or the Iberian Peninsula, which also includes what we now call Portugal. Some have limited it to that. It later came to be identified with the British Isles as the edge of the world, Wales in particular. When they found out the world didn't have an edge, then Tarshish became awkward to plant. By Ezekiel's day, the British Isles were well known. The ships of Tarshish there reached to the edge of the world, which is the British Isles. But let's continue. Thus we have the prophecy concerning the ships of Tarshish. Be still. The margin has it, be silent. This is Isaiah 23, verse 2. Be silent, ye inhabitants of the isles. Thou whom the merchants of Zidon that pass over the sea have replenished. Now that chapter, Isaiah 23, points to the far west. And the Phoenician city of Zidon, companion city to Tyre, where you always found the Danites, as I said last night, the cunning craftsmen from Tyre, was of a daughter of Dan. These merchants of Zidon are replenishing the isles that are the western isles in Isaiah 23, and God commands them to be silent. Also in the sixth verse, Pass ye over to Tarshish. Howl, ye inhabitants of the isle. Is this your joyous city, Tyre, whose antiquity is of ancient days? Her own feet or means of travel shall carry her afore off to sojourn. They're going to be carried afore and live in a far-off place. In these scriptures, we're informed that the isles of the sea were replenished by the ships whose seaports were Tyre and Zidon, ports of Palestine. Also, the people by whom the islands were replenished or peopled are commanded to keep silent. Just as this same prophet in another place, and you'll remember that prophecy, as I taught on it when I was going through the promises, where Israel is told to keep silent in their place, islands. And I asked the question then, where are islands in Palestine? In the Dead Sea? Fat tourists floating around. Just as this same prophet in another place commands Israel and the island to keep silent until they should renew their strength. So God gives a command of silence to Tyre and to Sidon that replenishes these islands. And where you find Tyre and Sidon, you find Danites. They are commanded to keep silent about these islands, as in another place, Israel in the islands was commanded to keep silent. Why? Now you're starting to get enough gestalt that this can ring for you. They were to be hidden for a fixed number of years. That's why the last decade of the 1700s becomes important, as the time span of silence runs and the evidence of their location is allowable to be exposed. That's why the 1800s becomes such a crescendo of archaeology about this subject matter. When Shalmaneser descended upon Israel, king of Assyria, he did not disturb those portions of the tribes of Dan and Simeon, which were dwelling on the southwest coast of Palestine. For the kingdom of Judah was then at peace with Assyria and lay between them and Samaria. However, both Dan and Simeon had large colonies in the interior. Dan in the north, we just read about that in Judges 18, where they moved inland and formed colonies. Renamed the territory Dan. Simeon in the east at Mount Seir, the region formerly occupied by the Amalekites, and the record of their occupying that territory is in 1 Chronicles 4. These portions of Dan and Simeon that form pockets of settlements inland went with the rest of Samaria, Israel, or the 10 tribes, into Assyria, and with them passed out through the Caucasian Pass, when the Assyrians carried the 10 tribes into bondage. The time of their defeat and final capitulation was when Samaria had been made the capital by the sixth king, Khumri, and I've said this 100 times, we confuse Khomeini and Khomeini because we don't know how to pronounce that aspirant sound. They therefore by the Assyrians were called Beit Khumri, never Israel, but rather House of Umri, who had moved the capital to Samaria. And we didn't know this till the 1800s, when archaeologists uncovered the name by which the Assyrians addressed them, Beit Khumri or House of Umri. In addition to these 10 tribes, north of that band that became the kingdom of Judah, Benjamin to the north and Judah to the south combined, the capital of Judah was Hebron. The capital of Benjamin was Samaria. David was king over Judah for 7 years before the whole of Israel united under him. He then moved by a conquering move. He took Jerusalem that had never been taken by the Benjamites in their lot assignment. And then he moved the capital from Hebron to Jerusalem, still opposed by certain Orthodox Jews who felt he moved it from the divine holy place picked by Abram. This band of Benjamin and Judah became the nation of Judah at the death of Solomon. North of it, Jeroboam formed the so-called ten-tribed kingdom. It was ten-tribe because there were interior settlements by these Danites and the Simeonites whose lot of territory was south of the kingdom of Judah. But they had already begun to abandon it to the Philistines and to others, which would be conquered by the people at various times and then reconquered back. These interior groups of Danites and Simeonites, when the rest of the house of Israel was carried into bondage by Assyria, went with them. That's what this writer is referring to as the overland route. The others had become seafaring on the coast. These portions of Dan and Simeon, the pockets of resettlement interior, went with the rest of Samaria, Israel, into Assyria. And the last reference of those tribes is they decided not to return to Palestine in 2 Ezra. But took counsel among themselves and decided to hunt out a territory where they could practice their own laws, and for a year and a half passed through the headwaters of the Euphrates River that takes them through the Caucasus Mountains to become, I believe, when they reemerge, the Celts. From college days until now, I've never found a historian that can tell me where the Celts came from. They just appeared out of nowhere at the same place the lost tribes disappeared. The last reference to the lost tribes that have been resettled, they go through the Caucasus Mountains, north of the Black Sea, and the Celts appear. First reference by Herodotus, Greek historian. Now, the last 20 years of archaeology have traced the Celts through the Caucasus to the area south of the Caspian Sea and around Lake Van. That's exactly where the lost tribes were. All I'm saying is it was either the damnedest collision or they're one and the same. And there's no record of the battle. Now maybe we'll find some record in archaeology of the first genocide. Well, then the question is who wiped out who? Or who wiped out whom? Maybe the lost tribes wiped out the Celts, took the territory, and took their name. It's what the Slavs did. We don't have any trouble believing that. The Slavs moved into Germany, the geographic area where the tribe, Celtic tribe, the Germani, had settled. The land took the name after the Germani. The Slavs moved in, the Germani moved on, the Slavs became the Germans. Oh, that's okay, because that doesn't prove God did anything. But for Israelites to move to a territory and become Celts, that's awful. It might prove God was in control. There is a demon force in this world, the prince of the power of the air, that will fight any thought that suggests confirmation of God's faithfulness. The territory into which, or the territory into and through which the ten tribes made their escape was just north of the Caucasus, which in ancient geography, as may be seen by consulting ancient maps, was known as the territory of the Sarmatians, while the pass or gate was sometimes called the Sarmatian Gate. Not a few have shown, and upon good grounds, that the name of Sarmatia was derived from Samaria, the earlier home of these wandering people, whose general name among themselves was Scolati, but whom the Greeks called Scythians, which means nomads. From that word Scoloti or Scolati, we have the more modern name Scoti, and still more modern Scots, which of course means the same as the Greek Scythian and nomad, wanderers. Now Scythian has taken on a word of some unknown tribe, characterized by good horsemanship and great archers. They rode horses and could shoot like hell. many at a time. For that designation, the Apaches were Scythians. The word comes from Scuth, the same word that the Feast of Tabernacles comes from the habit of living in temporary structures, booths, that they, too cold in here, ultimately began to construct their little tents on wagons so they could move everything wherever they went. Well, but that means this whole country of the United States with those Conestogas or desert wagons, wagon trains, they were Scythians. They just had rifles instead of arrows and were fighting people that had arrows and rode horses. When the Indians took over the wagon train, if they'd ridden in it instead of burning it, we'd have had true Scythians. The original name simply means nomads. This is only one of the many names by which these wanderers are Scots. Hey, that's what's wrong with me. I've been here too long. I think that's the problem. I got an anniversary coming up. Maybe I've been here too long. I need to start wondering again. You know what used to be the closest thing to heaven on earth to me? A plane with a one-way ticket to a city I hadn't been to. I was born for that life. Particularly if the city was on a beach. This is only one of the many names by which these wanderers or Scots may be traced. For in their western march across the European continent, which was necessarily slow, Ephraim did obey the prophetic injunction. Jeremiah gave it to him. Set thee up waymarks. And just here we must keep in mind the fact that in the ancient Hebrew there are no written vowels. And that in the word Dan there are only two letters used, which are the equivalent of the English D and N. Hence it makes note, see if this sounds repetitive, that's what I'm trying to achieve tonight, to give us a gestalt. There are many people that have done this. Why has the church neglected all of this? Scared they might learn something? Hence, it makes no difference if the word is Dan, Don, Dun, Din, or Din. Din or Dan, or Din or Dun. Don't count, I don't care who we're joining, doesn't matter to me. It is equal to the Hebrew DN, in which the speaker sounds the vowel according to the characteristics of his own dialect. Hello, whomever joined us, I can't stop for you. On the west side of the Black Sea, there is, according to ancient geography, a region which was called Moesia. West side of the Black Sea. Signifying the land of the Mosesites. And the people of that land are called Moesi. Or Mosesites. These people had such great reverence for a person. You remember I brought an archaeology book here one night on Thrace? Showed you pictures of this hero figure. Written by an archaeologist that had absolutely no connection to biblical studies at all. These people had such great reverence for a person whom they called Zalmoxes. I told you then. He had all the characteristics of a mythological extension of the work and life of Moses, whom Herodotus, the father of history, supposed to be their god. And concerning whom he concludes his account as follows. Zalmoxes must have lived many years before Pythagoras. This is Herodotus talking, the father of history. Whether therefore he was a man or a deity of the Jeti, enough has been said of him. T.R. Hallett says, quote, Zalmoxes, whom Herodotus supposed them to worship as a god, is without doubt Moses. Zal signifying chief or leader, while Moxes and Moses are but the Greek for the Hebrew Mosi, which is also rendered Moses in our tongue. Now, we're prone to think of these as Danites who never came under the Jewish religion as developed by the kingdom of Judah and refined in most of its elements after the return from Babylon. And the 10 tribes that broke off right after the death of Solomon, they have more heritage attachment to Moses than to these later figures that so dominate Scripture. Very natural for them to elevate Moses to a godlike state. Moesha was bounded on the south by Macedonia and the Dardanelles, and on the north by the river Danube, in the territory of Sarmatia, which in some maps is Scythia, in others Gomer. There are the rivers Dnieper, Dniester, and the Don. The fact that the Dnieper and the Dniester are written without a vowel between the D and the N is quite as significant as the fact that the Don has one. It's starting to sound repetitious? Supposed to. I hope it makes you want to kill some of your history teachers, particularly Bible history teachers. Professor Totten says, there's no grander theme upon the scrolls of history than the story of this struggle of the Anglo-Saxons westward. The very streams of Europe mark their resting places, and in the root of nearly all their ancient names, Dan or Don, recall the sacred stream Jordan, which means, by the way, spreading Dan, spreading judgment, or spread out judge, from whose banks so far away as exiles they set out. It was either the little colony of Dan, obeying its tribal proclivity for naming everything it captured after their father, or else the mere survival of a word and custom. Take your choice. A mere survival of a word and custom, or Dan actually as it traveled, continuing its proclivity in the three references in Joshua and Judges to stamp its name on every place it went. Nonetheless, it serves to trace these wanderers like a trail. The Danube, the Dnieper, the Dniester, the Danau, the Danin, the Danaster, the Dandari, the Danez, the Dasi, the Davi, the Dan, the Don, the Udon, the Eridon, and thousand other Dans and Dons of ancient and early geography down to the Danes and Danemark, or Dan's last resting place. To this we would add that during all these years of blindness concerning the birthright tribes, the people of Denmark have been called Danes or Danes. And that the people in contiguous countries, while having different local names, have been called by the same generic name, Scandinavians. Also that Denmark, the modern form of Danemark, means Dan's mark.
This is the end of Side 1. For the rest of the teaching,